to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. Thanks so much for joining us. We've got a big show ahead of you, but we're going to start out small, very small as the nucleus of an atom, in fact. This is a story we saw in the Ames Tribune that caught our interest, a collaboration between a local business, Technical Services Incorporated, and Brookhaven National Physics Laboratory with its relativistic heavy ion collider, otherwise known as RIC. With us are two guests intimately involved with either end of this project. Gary Simpson, one of three brothers who are co-owners of Technical Services Incorporated, a custom manufacturing business started by his father, and Professor John Lajoie, a nuclear physicist at Iowa State University, who is involved in the particle collision experiments being performed at Brookhaven. Welcome to you both.
Good to be here.
Good morning, Greta.
So, Gary, 3 months ago, you got a call from Brookhaven asking whether you could fabricate a specific part or parts of their new collider. Can you describe the piece that you're making?
Yeah, you know, the amazing power of the Internet. I think it was actually a web inquiry through our website. Got a hold of us, and we had the right equipment to help them manufacture some of the parts they needed. It's basically a large chunk of stainless steel that we machine into what's referred to as a slat in the assembly of the process.
Is this slat flat or curved?
It's a large flat blank that we machine into a tapered piece.
Okay, tapered. So it's still within a plane.
Yes.
Okay. And John, maybe you can explain how this tapered piece fits into the larger assembly.
Sure.
Of the collider.
The tapered pieces go into what we call a module. And these modules, there will be 32 of them that will form a ring. So the modules come together to form a circle. And the reason for the tapering in the slats is we want to have a gap or a groove in these modules that stays the same thickness from the inner radius to the outer radius. And so that means the plates need to change thickness. That we have sort of very tight tolerances on that gap or that groove because that's where the active material, what we call plastic scintillator, for the detector goes.
Okay, so the slats are making the perimeter of the module.
The slats actually make the interior of the module. So if you think of the modules as forming a circle, the slats point almost along the radius of the circle. So they point from inside to outside.
Okay. I'm picturing like a tube.
That's actually a good way to picture it, right? So it's a long tube, about a little over a meter long. And if you were to take that tube and just cut little pieces out of it along the long side, that would be a module.
Okay. And then these tubes, are they then put together in a ring or a long tunnel?
Well, they're put together in the modules themselves will come together and form a tube, and that tube forms the inner part of a particle detector that we plan to build.
A particle detector. That's
right.
That's the key because the whole idea behind this is that you kind of move these particles at high speeds together. They crash in this zone where you've got a detector
exactly
situated,
exactly.
And you want to see what happens.
That's right.
Okay, so there must be just a gazillion of these tapered pieces that you have to make over at your company.
Right now, we're in the experimental phase to see if the equipment we have will actually be able to meet some of the tolerances that were mentioned. Like you said, there's some very tight tolerances. You know, we're talking big science here, so have to make sure everything's fitting well and within tolerances that they require.
Okay. But ultimately, I can imagine that to make as many modules as you need, 32, I think 30, you said?
32 modules, and there's six different slats in a module.
Oh, okay. And then six different in number or six different types?
There's two different types.
Okay.
There's the interior slats, and then there's the slats on the sides, which are half as thick, so that when you put one module up against another, you get a full thickness plate in between them.
Okay. Okay. So there's a lot of machining going to happen. And I'm sure, you know, then there's the machine that machines the machining, that does the machining, and that has to be taken care of too.
You bet. It's one of those unique things where stars aligned. We had actually recently purchased a large CNC milling machine that has capacity big enough on the, what we say, the X-axis, thinking about a coordinate measuring system. It's long enough to do the slats, and it's we're kind of a unique animal as far as having that capability in the Midwest.
Wow, that is a nice coincidence.
You bet.
So by the X-axis, you're talking about the 1 meter long?
Yeah, the length of them.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you're building the, it's called a calorimeter?
Calorimeter, that's right.
Calorimeter, that's the detection device.
That's the name of the type of detector that we're trying to build, that's right.
Okay, and those 32 modules are part of the calorimeter.
That's right.
But there's a much bigger picture of the thing that's moving these particles together, right? You're
right.
Nodding.
Sure, sorry.
You said it's like a couple kilometers?
So the relativistic heavy ion collider is a storage ring and collider out at Brookhaven National Lab on Long Island, and it's about 2.2 kilometers in circumference.
Okay, so they whirl around.
That's right, and that's actually the final stage. There's actually a series of accelerators, a low-energy accelerator which feeds into a next energy and a higher energy and a higher energy, and the final step of that is the relativistic heavy ion collider.
Okay. Well, first let's talk about heavy ions.
Mm-hmm.
These are just the nucleus of an atom stripped of its electrons.
That's correct. We take a heavy atom. The gold is one of the ones that we like. It's easy for us to accelerate. We've done all the way up to uranium, but we take the atom and we strip off the electrons, and that gives us something with a positive charge, and that's something that we can then accelerate with electric fields.
So there's, I remember from freshman science that then there would be protons and neutrons in the nucleus stripped of its electrons.
That's correct. And what we're interested in is actually not just the protons and neutrons, but the protons and neutrons themselves are made up of smaller particles called quarks.
Uh-oh.
And they're held together with even different particles called gluons. And so what we're interested in by colliding these nuclei is freeing these quarks and gluons from the being confined into protons and neutrons.
Starting to sound like Star Trek.
Well, it kind of
free the quarks.
Well, it kind of is a little bit. You know, we talk about a new state of matter that we've discovered and created at Rick called the quark gluon plasma, which itself sounds like a Star Trek term.
And this is, I understand, all for the purpose of determining what really happened at the beginning of the universe.
That's right. So if you think of ordinary nuclei, and if you think of compressing them and heating them, they undergo a phase transition that's a lot like melting ice. And so the phase of this collection of quarks and gluons changes from being a phase where they're combined inside the protons and neutrons to where they sort of melt and form one big hot plasma. And we think that that plasma was very similar to the early state of the universe when it was a few microseconds old. What really holds the quarks together is an exchange of gluons. In particle physics, a force is really just exchanging a special type of particle between the two things that are feeling the force.
Okay, sure.
And so in this what we call strong interaction physics, that particle that's exchanged is the gluon. And so ordinarily, when the nuclear matter is very cold, that force is so strong that it holds the quarks bound into groups of three or two. And so protons and neutrons are made up of three quarks. If you heat them up, that force weakens enough so that you create something that's about the size of the nucleus, but now the quarks aren't confined into the protons and neutrons, but they can sort of swim over a larger region. So it's a hot soup of interacting quarks and gluons.
Wow. I can see the analogy of melting ice, a phase transition between kind of the solid, quote unquote, where you have 3 quarks per particle, mm-hmm. per proton or neutron, and then a kind of liquid form where they're just sort of squishy all over the place.
That's right.
And the hypothesis is that this was the state of matter at the very beginning of time, I guess.
That's right. So it's really a question of temperature or energy. And we know that early after the Big Bang, the universe was extremely hot. Right. And so as it cooled, it definitely cooled through a phase where the quarks and gluons sort of were a free quark gluon plasma and then cooled and sort of froze out to the nuclear matter that we know today.
Okay. And how are the experiments that you're doing? Are you kind of trying to prove that hypothesis or test the hypothesis?
So that's where we started out in around the year 2000 when Rick started running. It was a hypothesis that the quark gluon plasma would exist, but it had never been created in the laboratory. And so our first goal was to create the quark gluon plasma in the laboratory and measure its properties, sort of prove that we had created it. And that was the first phase of what we call the Rick mission. We have established that the quark gluon plasma exists. And now what we want to do is we want to study its properties in great detail. And that's the reason for the new experiment called S-Phoenix that we're working on designing. And that leads right into the work that we're doing with TSI.
TSI Technical Services Incorporated, with the three Simpson brothers at the head here in Ames, manufacturing parts for this collider, this new or actually it's for the new detector of the collider at Brookhaven National Laboratory on Long Island.
That's right.
We're speaking with John Lajoie, a physics professor at Iowa State University, and Gary Simpson, one of the brothers who owns the business that's manufacturing that part. Now, this is completely theoretical physics, right? There's no application, or is there?
Well, that's always a good question. I like it when people ask that question. Back in the early 1800s, many people were doing research into electricity. In fact, Benjamin Franklin, one of the founding fathers of our country, was also one of the great early pioneers in the study of electricity. And at that time, nobody had any idea of what the applications of the study of electricity might be. And yet we look around us and our modern society is entirely driven by the discoveries that were made at that time. So I don't know what the practical applications might be, but I have great faith in human spirit and ingenuity. It will probably happen long after I'm gone, but I'm sure that this will have applications at some point.
Wow, finding the properties of quarks and gluons. That's what they're doing out there. Now, we've heard a lot about another big experimental physics project involving a collider in Switzerland, the CERN collider.
Right.
And in fact, the news came out that they had discovered the quote-unquote God particle. What are the differences between the project at Brookhaven and the project at CERN?
So the project at Brookhaven is tuned to a very specific energy, and that's the energy that's related to this phase transition for the quark gluon plasma. The Large Hadron Collider at CERN was originally designed to find, as you said, the Higgs boson, this God particle. And so it's designed for a much, much higher energy. In fact, it's also a much larger machine. In circumference, it's maybe 10 times larger than the relativistic heavy ion collider. So the ring actually crosses under the border between France and Switzerland, and the ring actually runs under the city of Geneva. Very different physics goals, although I should say the LHC has also collided heavy ions. And we're learning a great deal by comparing what they measure at extremely high energies and what we measure right near the region of the phase transition.
And you said that the heavy ions, you've collided all different types of things. You've done gold, you've done uranium, and you've said you've also gone all the way down to the hydrogen atom.
That's right. That's one of the unique things about the Rick Collider is it's not limited to a particular range of particles. So we've collided proton on proton, gold on gold, uranium on uranium, and then we've done some oddball ones. Deuteron on gold. Deuteron is a proton and a neutron. We've also done helium on gold, copper on gold. So a small nucleus on a heavy nucleus.
You know, it just seems to boil down to the interest of a kid. I picture myself and my brother taking a rock that's made out of granite and throwing it as hard as we could at another a larger granite rock and seeing what happens.
Well, physicists get much more professional about it as they get older, but fundamentally it's the same curiosity.
Okay. Well, I'm kind of at the limit of questions that I can ask. I really don't understand too much of this, but it's been really wonderful to try to explore it with you guys.
Well, I sure appreciate being here, Greta.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Gary Simpson of Technical Services Incorporated and Professor John LaJoie of ISU. And when we come back, an Ames woman who is standing up to Dakota Access, the company that wants to build a crude oil pipeline across the state. This is Greta Anderson on Local Talk, and I just realized I forgot the weather report for today.
Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. I need to laugh. And when the sun is out, I've got something I can laugh about. I feel good in a special way. I'm in love and it's a sunny day. Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. We take a walk. The sun is shining down, burns my feet as they touch the ground.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson, and we move now from particle colliders to large installations of an entirely different variety. Linda Merkin, Ames resident on the steering committee of the Bakken Pipeline Resistance Coalition, noticed something unusual. I assume that you were driving along Highway 35, possibly, and noticed something unusual and looked into it. The actions she took resulted in the state warning the company Dakota Access of a possible $100,000 fine, which may be decided upon today at their meeting. Linda Merkin, glad to have you with us.
It's good to be back.
Tell us how this story began.
Well, I've been a member of the Bakken Pipeline Resistance Coalition for over a year now. A lot of people have been standing up to Dakota Access a lot longer than I have. But we have about 30-odd organizations, more than 30 organizations now that are members of this coalition and are continuing to work on this. Now, just quickly, last summer, we put together some maps here in Story County to show the pipeline's route and where the pumping station would be. And we have the sole pumping station, or would have the sole pumping station for Iowa.
The crude oil that's passing through the pipeline is very heavy, viscous substance, and so it doesn't just flow. It needs to be pumped under high pressures, and sometimes it even needs to go uphill. And so that's why we have a pumping station, right?
Correct.
And that's going to be located right here in Story County.
Yes. So March 10th, the IUB said they would grant a permit to Dakota Access, but they did not grant a final permit. There's several conditions they asked Dakota Access to fulfill. And there's also U.S. Army Corps of Engineers who still hasn't given their blessing to this.
Some of the conditions involved the indemnity, how much money they're going to insure this thing for.
Yes, $25 million as opposed to the $250,000 that Iowa statute requires. Also, some more improvements to the agriculture impact mitigation plan so they don't totally destroy our topsoil.
And so they have to demonstrate these plans and these insurance policies to the Iowa Utilities Board before they can proceed with construction.
And then they ask for expedited treatment. In other words, let's do it tomorrow. Just give us permission right away. And the board stood up to them and said no. We've got lots of things to look at here. They're important issues. We are going to take the time that we need to look at these. So anyway, here's what happened. March 10th is when the Utilities Board gave this ruling. Sometime after that, I was driving to Des Moines to a meeting, and I saw this construction going on over to the east side of I-35. It's about 2 miles, I think it was 1.6 miles, north of the interchange with Highway 210. And I thought, that looks suspicious. went back, looked at my map, said, yeah, that's about where the pumping station should be. So the next time I went to Des Moines, I think I was on the way back, I took the 210 exit, I went over to the next county road, 570th, and I just started driving north, looking at my odometer. And guess what? About 1.6 miles or around there, I looked to my left, and there's this dirt road that's really kind of chewed up and looks really crummy. But it's also got these big – they look like huge railroad ties that are right at the entrance of it. And it looks like, goodness, somebody's been trying to shore this thing up so they can get something pretty heavy. And then I looked toward the end, and I could see that there was construction. Did not go down it because I didn't think my car would make it, and I didn't – you know, didn't want to do that to my car. So anyway, I looked into it, found out that it was an electrical substation being constructed by CIPCO, Central Iowa Power Cooperative, and I guess their local partner called Consumers Energy.
So an electrical substation is sort of a supplemental provider of electricity?
It's something you need if you're going to have a big consumer.
Right, okay.
Is my understanding.
Right, which a pumping station would be.
Yes, so I called CIPCO, and they gave me good information. They were very upfront with the information, and they said, that we are doing a substation there with our partner there. Dakota Access purchased the land, deeded it to us. Dakota Access is paying a good share of the construction. I said, that's interesting. How much is the construction, and what share is Dakota Access paying? Well, Dakota Access is a private company, so I can't disclose that. So, okay, I thought, well, let's kind of keep going. I called the Office of Consumer Advocates within the Attorney General's office and talked to an attorney there who referred me to the Utilities Board, talked to a staffer at the Iowa Utilities Board. And anyway, they're investigating the complaint. And there was also some tree clearing, by the way.
Right.
Yeah, to the north of there. And a lot of tree clearing and burning. And that to me was rather suspicious. What is that about? So I brought that to their attention, too.
Now, I just have to say, you know, my husband and I were driving north from Des Moines sometime this month. We saw the same thing. We actually saw these pillar-type things on the side of the road, and we both thought, well, maybe that has to do with the pumping station. But you know, I'm just comparing my behavior to yours. You went the extra mile, literally, to find out what was going on.
Well, I had the map, and I knew that was, you know, I was concerned and curious because I had a map, and I knew that the pumping station was going to be there. So I had the time, and I thought, why not just drive around a little bit?
And the big concern of this all is that technically the company should not be constructing anything, should not be making anything permanent until they have complete permission from all the authorities.
Correct. And I know CIPCO is doing this, but Dakota Access gave them the land. Dakota Access gave them the money. It's primarily because Dakota Access is going to be such a large energy consumer, electrical energy consumer there. I mean, it's obvious there's a nexus between this. Mm-hmm. So that's why I wanted to contact people and say, what's going on? The other thing is there's tree clearing that has been noticed in, I think, Wapello County and Lee County, and some members of the coalition there have also made complaints, and the Sierra Club, on behalf of the three counties, incorporated these three complaints into a petition with the Iowa Utilities Board. And the petition from the Sierra Club asks for more than just a fine. It asks them to reverse their order granting the permit. Oh. I have not seen anything yet about the Utilities Board addressing that petition. Huh. But that's a big one to follow.
Right. So, I mean, we're talking about the behavior of a corporation that kind of is acting as if it already owns state. We've been told a lot that this thing is inevitable, and they'd piled up all the materials that they needed to make the pipeline, and they're acting, you know, as if they have permission, they don't quite yet.
Exactly. And that makes you wonder about any guarantees that Dakota Access gives to the residents of Iowa or to the government of Iowa. I'm quite frankly very skeptical that they will do things the way they're promising to do right now, because the other thing is they want to have construction done by the end of this calendar year. That's fast construction. This is a huge pipeline. It's a 30-inch pipeline going from the far northwest to the far southeast of Iowa. It's a huge, huge project. They have to get permission from counties to cross drainage districts. They still have to get some permissions from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. By the way, the Story County supervisors, let me just say this quickly. Dakota Access, I've been told, came to them and asked them to put some gravel on that dirt road, that 303rd lane. Good for the county supervisors. They said, no, we don't maintain that road. It's a Class B road. We don't maintain it, and we're not going to do that. Then they have a request to vacate that road. I assume Dakota Access and SIPCO want it so they can maintain it themselves so they can get their heavy construction equipment in there because they still have to build the pumping station, and they're not done with the substation, and the road's a mess. The other thing that's going to happen tomorrow at the Board of Supervisors meeting is they have a resolution on their agenda that would set conditions, and it's not granting an easement. Some people said that. They're not planning on granting an easement to Dakota Access tomorrow. But they're setting conditions that if they were to grant an easement later to Dakota Access or anybody else who wants to put a crude oil pipeline through Story County, that these conditions would apply.
Okay. So just to back up a little bit, Story County was asked by the pipeline company to maintain a road that they would not otherwise maintain, this road leading to the substation, leading to the pumping station, which is right beside I-35 near Cambridge. And Story County supervisors just said, no, we don't serve you. If it were serving a public good, maybe, a public use, this is something we would consider, but
I was told that Dakota Access had come to them, asked them to do this, and they had said, no, it's not in the taxpayer's interest, exactly.
The taxpayer's interest, right. Well, it sounds like, you know, after allowing the company through the door quite a bit, that we're starting to see just a beginning of a little bit of resistance from our governments. The state government, the IUB and Story County now are kind of saying, now, wait a minute, you don't own us. You know, we are here to represent the people, and we're not going to we're not here providing giveaways.
Exactly. And I think Dakota Access has brought them on their own company by their bad behavior. They get a permit, you know, tentatively from IUB and the Iowa Utilities Board, and they say, you have to do these conditions. So they throw a bunch of paper at them and say, okay, can we start tomorrow? I mean, I don't know if it was exactly that, but it was pretty much that.
We saw the headlines in the Des Moines Register.
Yeah, expedited treatment. And that makes me so skeptical. You know, even if there are conditions on an easement, if there are conditions on an order from IUB, that they're going to honor those. I'm very worried about it.
Right. So the meeting tomorrow, just to clarify, the Story County Supervisors meeting, it is about this road again, this very poorly maintained road that leads to nowhere, basically.
And I see the road as the minor issue, but I think we still need to talk about it. And I should clarify, the conditions that they would be setting by resolution are for crossing drainage districts. And this is one of these little real complicated things. The Story County supervisors also act as the drainage district trustees for the county. So they will be kind of doing a recess and going into a session as drainage district trustees to look at this resolution and to act upon the resolution. And it would apply only to drainage districts. But there is another issue. Because there is another thing that Dakota Access needed to file called an agricultural impact mitigation plan. And that really says, how are you going to put this all back together? How are you going to put this soil back together? How are you going to protect our prime farmland, you know, just every place, not just in drainage districts? I don't know where that is going, where the conditions are going to be on that. But that's another issue that we need to look at, is how the county is going to oversee the construction to make sure that everything in the agriculture impact mitigation plan is followed.
Oh, and that could be an expense on the county, too. I mean, who's going to oversee it? That takes man hours. That takes person hours. That takes
the 18 counties that the pipeline is slated to cross have agreed to, I think most of them agreed to go together and to hire an engineering firm to oversee that. That engineering firm is named in the resolution about the drainage districts. I don't know if that same engineering firm will deal with the entire county or not. And that's one of the things I'm interested in finding out.
And presumably, the bill for that engineering firm should presumably be paid by the pipeline company. But then you have a conflict of interest where the person who's paying you is, you know, the one that you have to oversee.
And Dakota Access is supposed to pay for that. I hope that goes through the county somehow, and I hope the county has a very lead role in that so it doesn't look like this engineering firm thinks they're working for Dakota Access, because that would be a disaster.
Right. Wow, there's a lot of complicated issues. We're really glad that someone like you is on the ball and is going to go to the county supervisors meeting and ask them all of these really tough questions.
Well, there's a lot of people in these 18 counties who are going to be going to county supervisors meetings, I think, in the near future. And I encourage everybody to really kind of look around. And if there are questions, you see something that looks like it's on the pipeline route, ask.
Right.
We need to ask questions now. We need to get more information.
Okay. Well, once again, thanks, Linda Merkin, for your watchdog presence, your curiosity, and your scrutiny of what's going on. When we return, we've got a couple of guests from the county, the Story County Emergency Management Services.
Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. Then we lie beneath a shady tree. I love her and she's loving me. She feels good. She knows she's looking fine. I'm so proud to know that she is mine. Good day, sunshine. 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 Good day, sunshine.
Welcome back to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. Well, we've had two pretty heavy segments this morning, a relativistic heavy ion particle collider to discover the origin of the universe, and efforts to fight back against a corporation that some people would say acts like it owns the state. Let's turn to something a little lighter, shall we? Something like disaster preparedness. With us are Melissa Spencer, Deputy Coordinator of Story County Emergency Management, and the program's intern, Samantha Lawrence. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And Melissa, you're taking the place of Keith Morgan, who usually comes to the studio on the first Monday of the month to help us plan for our safety. And you are using this slot to talk about an event at the end of the month called Spring Fury.
Yeah, we are working with our Story County Coalition for Disaster Recovery, which is an organization of faith-based, nonprofit, and other governmental organizations that come together to look at what gaps can be filled in our disaster response and recovery for Story County. One of our events that we thought would be good to bring back is our Spring Fury Community Preparedness Event. And I will go ahead and let Samantha, she's done a majority of our planning work with it, and let Samantha kind of talk a little bit about our speakers and things that are coming in.
Okay, great. This is Saturday, April 30th?
Yes.
30th. Yeah.
Yep. So we are actually going to have a few presentations. One of them is our keynote speaker. Her name is Stephanie Brady, and she's the Assistant Executive Director with the Independent Living Center in Joplin. She's going to be discussing her experiences with the tornado in Joplin on May 22nd of 2011. We are also going to have Jason Sudeiko from KCCI and Ben McMillan from the Iowa Storm Chasers. They're presenting and sharing information about how to register for alerts and talk about weather radios. They're going to actually have their vehicle. It's a van. It's modified they use to track tornadoes. It's called Dorothy.
From The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah. So anyone can go and they'll be able to look at that and kind of see what they do from day to day. We're also going to have Ron Edwards, and he works with the Ames Animal Control, presenting about pets and animals being prepared during disasters. We're going to have various other events, Melissa, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, we're going to have the ISU Meteorology Club is going to bring their virtual tornado. Which
Ooh,
is very interesting.
A virtual tornado.
Yeah, the kids can actually come in and through a computer program control a tornado through a community.
Wow.
It's been kind of interesting, but they use it to study how tornadoes affect communities.
So this is a family event then?
Yeah, very much a family-oriented event. It is going to be from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the City Church on Oakwood here in Ames.
Okay. Oakwood is down south and west.
Yeah. Yep. South, just off of University.
Right.
That they're should be plenty of parking for folks. Mm-hmm. You know, it's open. It's free. We are going to have the pillowcase project for elementary school kids to learn how to prepare themselves and their families for disaster. And they will come home with a pillowcase that they get to draw on. And they'll just learn how to prepare a kit for themselves and their families. We're also going to have the Ames Fire Department is going to bring their fire safety house. And the Ames Police Department is going to be fingerprinting kids.
Oh, my goodness.
So we're going to have a wide variety of things going on that day, and activities inside and outside. Story County Amateur Radio Emergency Services is going to be present and is going to be educating the public about how amateur radio is used in disaster. And we're also going to be testing some of their equipment, communications equipment, as part of our event as well, for the planning committee to communicate that day throughout the event. So,
well, we've got some people here at the station, I think, who might be interested in that radio aspect of
everybody's
disaster
welcome.
Preparedness.
We've really tried to make everything as all ages as we can. We're going to have a free lunch that's going to be served by the Salvation Army and Red Cross. And we'll also have a weather radio giveaway as part of our event.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I've been wanting a weather radio for a while now.
Come
ever
sign
since
up.
Keith started coming in.
Yep.
Say a little bit more about the pillowcase project that the kids will be doing. What is that?
Yeah, so the Pillowcase Project is a very unique program that the American Red Cross puts on and is sponsored by Disney. There is a presenter discussing coping skills and various aspects that go into being prepared for a disaster, including making a preparedness plan to get out of your home in event of a fire. And they will discuss home fires and one other, like a tornado or flooding, a disaster related to your community. So they will – a big part of it is learning, like, the coping skills and how to handle what goes on in the event of a disaster.
And then where does the pillowcase come in?
At the end of the presentation, the students are given a white pillowcase with some Disney logos on it, and they are able to draw on there things like – you put in there, like flashlights, batteries, non-perishable food, and things like that.
Oh, and then presumably they'll go home and actually prepare this sack of stuff that will help them in case of an emergency.
And what they have found through many years of looking at children in disasters is when the children they found have come into shelter situations, what they do is they put all their most important things to them in a pillowcase. And so the kids they've actually have seen come in carrying their pillowcase when they come into an emergency sheltering situation. So Disney and the American Red Cross decided that would might be a good thing to capitalize on, but encourage the children to make sure that they're adding things, such as Sam mentioned, with the flashlight, their phone, different things like that, that they would need to go into the shelter.
Interesting. Okay. I'm kind of reminded of I'm too young actually for this experience, but folks maybe a decade or so older than I did the duck and cover in school. I mean, it seems like a preparing for the nuclear bomb. Although of course that would not help you too much, but it seems like we're kind of back into an era where we're really kind of expecting the worst.
You know, I mean, Story County is no stranger to disaster. I mean, we have our 100-year floods about every 2 years. And they have really found that reaching the youth, reaching the school-age children, is a good way to prepare the family. They find that a lot of these kids will take this information back to their parents and really encourage their parents to be prepared for whatever potential disaster could impact their community. And the kids are really good at holding the parents accountable. And so, you know, having a program that starts with the elementary age kids not only gets the family prepared, but then you're starting to build that culture of preparedness where if the children have grown up with it, as they become adults, they'll be better prepared and hopefully continue to build their plans and be able to sustain themselves for that first, 72 hours of a disaster.
Well, it sounds like a good plan, actually. there's always a fine line of trying to – you don't want to scare the kids.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
You don't want
and
them to
– The Pillowcase Project is very, you know, you're talking about coping skills and you're talking about disaster, but it's done in a very positive way.
Right.
And I think, you know, that doesn't alarm the children and you know, gives them something to go back and really have a good constructive conversation with their families on that importance of preparedness. You know, we're very lucky here that we have a lot of resources here in Story County, but, you know, if there was a very large widespread disaster, you know, that's why we ask people to prepare for that 3 days. It could take a while for some of those resources to reach here. So it's a good place to start with the kids.
Well, it's great work you're doing. Thank you so much for coming here and telling us about it. This is an event that the whole family can come to. Maybe the kids will be dragging the parents to this event on April 30th at the
City Church on Oakwood Road, 2400 Oakwood Road, and it'll be from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. with a free lunch.
Can't beat that. Well, I'm sure we'll be hearing more about it. We'll see it in the newspaper
forth. You'll start seeing more information come out probably this week.
Okay. Well, thank you so much,
Melissa. Thank you very much.
And Samantha, Melissa Spencer, Deputy Coordinator of Story County Emergency Management, and Samantha Lorenz, an intern. We're going to go out today with a word from our Community Service Appreciation Program. The City of Ames has designated the month of April as Good Neighbor Month. And so for this month's segment, Kay Puttock interviewed Mike Fritz, the Director of Good Neighbor Emergency Assistance in Story County.
I'm pleased to welcome the Director of Good Neighbor, Mike Fritz, who's been with the agency for 8 years.
Thank you so much, Kay. It's certainly a pleasure to be here.
Well, we were talking a bit before we started recording here, and we discovered that most of us at some point in our lives can use a bit of help. In the past, we used to get that help maybe from our family and neighbors, but Mike was saying that system seems to be breaking down now. It's not the same as it used to be.
I think it's very true, Kay. I think about my own life, and at the time when I was growing up, my grandparents literally lived less than a quarter of a mile from us. So in terms of support, it was right there when we needed it. Today, with families being so mobile and spread across not only the country but the world, we're seeing less and less support available to people when they really need help that they can't accomplish on their own. Mm-hmm. And that's where Good Neighbor steps in, to be that forum for assistance when they're in need.
Yes, and you are like a collaborating or coordinating agency for a whole slew of area agencies and nonprofits, right?
The story of Good Neighbor's beginnings, I think, really exemplifies what the organization is all about. Back in 1996, a group of 10 faith-based organizations came together. And when we think about faith-based organizations, inevitably, I think we think about what makes them different, what makes the Jewish congregation different from the Catholic congregation, different from the Methodist congregation. Back in 1996, these folks came together and said, let's lay our differences aside and let's talk about what makes us the same. And what made them the same was they all had a tenant to help those less fortunate than themselves. In their efforts to try to do that, they had experienced some difficulties. The first was sheer volume of clients. I remember talking to one pastor who talked about having 8 chairs outside of his office, and it was not unusual to see all 8 of those chairs filled with people waiting to try to get some level of monetary assistance to help them meet crisis situations. The second problem those churches were seeing was people were doing what was called church hopping. So they'd go from one church, get assistance, go right down the street to another church, get assistance there, go across the street to yet another. And there was no way to know what churches had provided assistance to what individual or family. The last problem these churches were seeing was when they did provide assistance, more often than not, they were handing people cash. And while you'd like to believe that that money was being used for what the person said, we know that not in all cases that was what was actually happening. So from those discussions, Good Neighbor was created, and the first office was opened in April of 1997. Consequently, April is designated as Good Neighbor Emergency Assistance Month through a proclamation by the City of Ames. And this year marks our 19th anniversary in providing services to Story County residents in need.
Now, you explained also, Mike, that you're basically an emergency organization. So when people's situations improve, you lose track of them. But nevertheless, you do have some statistics and some figures about how successful your emergency help has been for people.
That's very true, Kay. We are an emergency organization. So, for example, when we provide rent or utility assistance, once we've done that, we can't help that individual or family again with that type of assistance for a minimum of 1 year. In that way, we don't want individuals to become dependent on Good Neighbor, but rather to allow us to help them in emergency needs to get back on their feet and accomplish their goals on their own. For our rent and utility assistance program, last year, in the last fiscal year, 343 households from every community in Story County received rent and or utility assistance. We conduct follow-up surveys a minimum of 9 months after the assistance has been provided. And what we found was in FY13-14, which is the last year we have full statistics for, 76% of the individuals that had received rental assistance through Good Neighbor were either still in their homes or had moved in good standing with their landlord. 87% of the individuals that had received utility assistance either still had open accounts or had closed the account without leaving an outstanding balance. These surveys are conducted with property managers, landlords, and utility companies, so it's not based on the comments of the clients. Given the level of crisis that we see with the folks receiving Good Neighbor services, we think these numbers are very strong and truly do demonstrate that we are meeting the need that we're trying to address. Unlike our rent and utility assistance, where we only see people once a year, the Good Neighbor Healthy Food Voucher Program allows Story County residents to receive food vouchers that can be redeemed at one of 9 different grocery stores across Story County. Folks are eligible to come and get those vouchers on a quarterly basis. And in doing so, it's not unusual for us to establish and maintain relationships with people as they come each quarter to get their vouchers. Oftentimes, families will come together with their friends. And it's not unusual, because we do them on a quarterly basis, the first week of a new quarter, for us to see real abundance of people that are coming to get those vouchers. We find that as a way that we can provide some level of support for them. And as I say, we can establish relationships and kind of see how those folks are getting along. As the director of Good Neighbor, I'm the only paid employee at the organization, so we rely on a cadre of volunteers that do an outstanding job for us. They provide a variety of tasks, including data entry and then office management services, including answering phones, scheduling appointments, and helping folks fill out information, as well as distributing those healthy food vouchers. The volunteers that are currently at Good Neighbor, the vast majority of have been there as long as that I have been there, which is 8 years.
So your volunteers are very loyal and obviously enjoy working at Good Neighbor.
So often I think the volunteers, they always provide a level of support for our clients. It's not unusual to see our clients come in distress. They're in crisis situation. It's not unusual to see folks that are embarrassed or ashamed to have to be asking for help. And our volunteers do an outstanding job providing them with an ear to hear their concerns and a shoulder to cry upon at times. And so often the volunteers will say to me, I realize how good my life is by seeing what's going on in the lives of others. And they truly are the agency could not run or operate without their talents and the resources of that outstanding bunch of volunteers.
But there's room for more volunteers, is there?
Always, always room for more volunteers.
Okay, so, and why didn't you put in the website here so people can look it up? And
our website is GNEA.org. So it's Good Neighbor Emergency Assistance.org.
And there they can find out about volunteering or visiting your office and so on,
exactly.
Which is right here in Ames, but you can see it all on the website.
Certainly, certainly.
Although you tend to lose track of people when they move on and their life improves, nevertheless, there is a spot on your website for them to share their stories. And I believe you have some of those stories that you could share with us today.
We see individuals and families that access all of the services at Good Neighbor, whether it be our emergency rent and utility assistance program, our healthy food voucher program, or our gas voucher program, which is very much one of a kind in Story County, one of the very, very few places where people can get gasoline for emergency transportation issues. Some of the things that we see with clients, people often ask me about what similarities or common themes. And what I will tell you is everyone's story is different. So that I could talk about the young woman who came to Good Neighbor because her 2-year-old child had fallen from her crib and broken her leg. The child was in Blank Children's Hospital in Des Moines, and this young woman came to me in tears needing money for gasoline so that she could go and visit her baby. I can talk about the elderly woman whose father passed away in Texas, and she used all the rent money that she had to travel to Texas to get his ashes and to bring him back home. I can talk about the elderly woman who had fallen at her home, and while she didn't break any bones, she wasn't able to leave the home for a number of weeks. And finally, when she was healed enough to be able to get out and about, she came to get Good Neighbor food vouchers. And she talked about in the weeks that she had been bedridden, she had basically existed on canned soup and glasses of water. And as she clutched those food vouchers, she talked about how anxious she was to eat some fresh vegetables, wash them down with a glass of milk. The young man that came that was raising his son is just under 10, he's done his best to try to take care of that child, including trying to get together with the son's half-brother who lives in another neighboring community. They try to get together at least once a month, and he talked about how he really appreciated the summertime because on limited incomes for both families, during the winter it was hard to find things that the kids could do together that didn't cost money, but during the summer they could go to parks. He said it was important to him that his son knew his half-brother and had that relationship. And when I asked him about the child's mother, he said he had not had contact with her in a number of years and that the child virtually didn't know her or remember her. And then he turned to me and he said, "But you know, I can never change my phone number." And when I asked him why, he said, "That's the only number she has to be able to reach that child." And he says, "I can't shut that door. I'll always leave that door open so that when she's ready, she can come and talk with that child."
And that was Mike Fritz from the director of Good Neighbor Emergency Assistance. Good Neighbor is our focus for the Community Service Appreciation Program this month. Every month we focus on a different nonprofit. For more information, visit the Good Neighbor Emergency Assistance website at gnea.org. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We heard from Gary Simpson, co-owner of Technical Services Incorporated of Ames, John LaJoie, professor of nuclear physics from Iowa State University, about the part that Technical Services is manufacturing for the Brookhaven Heavy Ion Particle Collider and what this collider can tell us about the origins of the universe. Quarks and gluons, oh my! We also heard from Linda Merkin about the discovery of potential violations by the Dakota Access Pipeline Company and an item before the Story County supervisors tomorrow regarding the pipeline. We also heard from Melissa Spencer, Deputy Coordinator of Story County Emergency Management Services, and Samantha Lorenz, an intern, about the April 30th event Spring Fury. Sounds like a fun time. We ended the show with information about Good Neighbor Emergency Assistance. As I said, the focus of this month's Community Service Appreciation Program. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will find information about our guests, along with links relevant to today's stories, including the Ames Tribune stories on the particle collider and Linda Merkin's role in the Dakota Access reprimand. Thanks to Webmaster Ron Carson for posting that work. Remember to like us on Facebook and Twitter and get updates on all our show postings in your newsfeed. Local Talk was engineered by Nadia Abdelazim. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was The Beatles from their Revolver album. At KHOI, we have volunteers of all ages and descriptions. All you need is an enthusiasm for community, Please stop by the station to start your KHOI volunteer experience. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio. Mm-hmm.